you are standing and confessing this is both an incredibly dangerous moment in American history, but also an amazingly possible moment. When it's white folks in pain, we understand there are systemic causes. When it's black and brown folks in pain, we ignore the system and we focus on the individual and we blame them because we lack radical empathy.
You have to say black lives matter rather than all lives matter, because we said all men are created equal, endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. We said all, but we didn't mean all.
The whole history of America is the history of rich white men telling working class white people that their enemies are black and brown.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Speak Out with Tim Wise, a project of Speak Out, the nation's premier nonprofit speakers bureau, which for over 25 years has been bringing educators and activists to campuses and communities across America to engage in meaningful dialogue about the pressing issues that confront our country and the world. If you enjoy the program, one way you can express your support is to become a monthly patron and sustainer of the show by signing up at www.patreon.com/speakoutwithtimwise. You can pledge as little as $2 a month or as much as you'd like, and not only know that you're supporting our efforts, but also gain access to bonus content, like premium commentaries on the events of the week, as well as signed books or DVDs. You can also make a one-time donation to the program at speakoutnow.org via PayPal, and make sure to subscribe to the show on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. Well, I am assuming that you have heard of Antifa, that is short for anti-fascist. That is the movement, or perhaps one might say the activist contingent, that oftentimes confronts white nationalist, white supremacist, neo-Nazis, and other far-right figures in the streets of America, from Charlottesville, Virginia, back in 2017, during the Unite the Right rally, all the way out to Portland, Oregon, where anti-fascists have clashed with far-right organizers in a number of different organizations and contingencies over the years. Perhaps what you have heard about Antifa is that they are not actually anti-fascist, but fascist, that they are a new brand of leftist authoritarianism, that they are themselves committed to a politic of fascism. Perhaps you have heard that they are violent. Perhaps you have heard that they are strategically inept because they confront Nazis rather than ignoring them. Or perhaps they even engage occasionally in physical confrontations and battles with neo-Nazis and white supremacists. And perhaps you are concerned about that either philosophically or at least strategically. Well, I assure you that much of what you have heard about Antifa has been filtered through a dominant corporate media narrative that does not always take into account the realities of what the anti-fascist movement is doing on the ground. The vast majority of the work of people who consider themselves members of, quote-unquote, members of Antifa, is not, in fact, street confrontation at all. If I were to guess, I would say probably 80% of the work of the Antifa movement is research and documentation. It is really investigative journalism and then exposing people with ties to the far right, including neo-Nazi and white supremacist organizations. And about 20% of their work is direct confrontation. Now, we can have debates and discussions about that 20%. We can even have debates and discussions about the 80%, because there are different views held by very good people about the extent to which we ought to be exposing average everyday folks for their politics and doxing them and releasing their personal information. And I understand the trepidation that some have about that. But I think at least if we're going to have that conversation, it is important for us to actually hear from people who are involved directly in quote-unquote Antifa, which is why I wanted to have my guest today on the program. I have known my guest today for several years. We have crossed paths many, many times. His name is Daryl Lamont Jenkins. He is a long-standing, I'm not going to say leader, because if you know about Antifa, you know it is a semi-anarchic type of movement with no clearly defined leaders or organizational structure, but he is certainly a well-known and respected figure within the world of Antifa here in the United States. At the age of 19, while he was serving in the military, Daryl saw an episode, as many of us did. I remember this episode of the Oprah Winfrey Show, which was on skinheads in America, and that led to him having a lifelong passion for documenting the politics of far-right hate. When he returned from the service, he became a part of the punk rock scene, produced two public access programs about the punk music that he was promoting and also political activism. Jenkins has been documenting and writing about right-wing individuals and organizations for just a little over 30 years, beginning when he served in the Air Force, and then later when he founded the One People's Project, and the organization One People's Project gained a reputation of publicly documenting hate groups and their activities. It is a practice known today, and many of us will be familiar with this term, as doxing. While One People's Project and Jenkins gained some notoriety over the years, it was not until Donald Trump's campaign for the presidency and his eventual victory that put Jenkins, the organization, and the entire Antifa movement into the spotlight. In 2018, the documentary Alt-Right, Age of Rage, came out that features Jenkins confronting white nationalist Richard Spencer, and that was a documentary that premiered at South by Southwest. So it is a great honor and joy to have Daryl on the program today to sort of dispel some of the myths about Antifa as a movement, and then to just sort of ask some very particular questions about white nationalism. What is the difference, for instance, between white nationalism and the nationalism that occasionally is manifested by people of color? To what extent is conservatism in America intrinsically linked to beliefs like racism, and then in addition to that, fascism? To what extent are Antifa tactics helpful or hurtful, and how do we know? What are the limits of certain tactics, whether that's doxing or whether that is a confrontation in the street? What is the value of Antifa as a movement in terms of research and the role that Antifa plays in sounding the early warning about certain figures who today have gained great prominence, but about whom several years ago only folks in Antifa were really speaking? Why is it that ignoring fascist and white supremacists doesn't work? What is the overlap between the extreme and the mainstream within the American right? And why is it there are Jews and people of color in the alt-right and neo-fascist movements? What's that about? Because that's a subject we don't always speak of nearly enough. That and a lot more in my conversation with Daryl Lamont Jenkins of One People's Project, a member and key figure in the American Antifa movement, when we return. The first thing I want to do, I think it is fair to say that you are someone who has been in the anti-fascist, anti-racist, anti-white supremacist movement for about as long as anyone in the U.S. has been, certainly at least in the contemporary period, and specifically speaking to that anti-fascist element of it. You know, there's so much misinformation about what Antifa as a movement, as a politic is, what anti-fascism as an ideology is all about. And I want to give you an opportunity as someone, and I know, you know, within Antifa, there's not really quote unquote leaders. It's a semi-anarchic structure, but there are certainly prominent persons within the anti-fascist movement, both in this country and around the world. So talk a little bit for people who aren't really familiar with what this work entails and what it's about, what it is and what it's not, because there's a lot of misinformation, obviously, that spread within corporate media and even sometimes liberal and left media. And I want to give you a chance to talk about what the movement against fascism in particular is about in this country.
Well, that's the thing. When you say misinformation, that's the perfect word for it. And because it's really done by design. Misinformation against Antifa is done by design. You take a look at who it is that's spreading it, and you're looking at the folks that we particularly go after. Why in the world folks on the liberal side and on the leftist side will take that ball and run with it is beyond me, but it's not the first time. You and I have both been in this for about the same amount of time,
right?
And we see this over and over and over again. So I appreciate the opportunity to explain what Antifa is. Antifa simply is being against fascism, not being fascist as the scuttlebutt would like to make you believe. It's about being against fascism and being against, being anti-authoritarian against those that want to try to basically put their boot on those and deny people their human rights, be it whether it's because of race, because of sexual identity, because of gender, because of class levels, whatever it is, all in the name of preserving their notion of what their country or what their nation is supposed to be. We reject that. I love the meme that comes out, that has come out recently, that says nationalism is nothing more than taking pride in something you've never done and hating people you've never met. It's the greatest breakdown of what nationalism is and how, in many respects, it is incredibly foolish. And I gotta stress that although when you talk about nationalism, when it's coming from black communities and what's coming from Hispanic communities, it really is nothing more than a defense mechanism against the white nationalism that has dominated this country. So it's a defense mechanism, more or less. I mean, it doesn't mean that I am cool with people hating white people. I'm not really down with that. By the same token, I understand where the nationalism comes from. And I think it still needs to be rejected. People need to get out of that frame of mind. But you cannot put it in the same category as, say, what David Duke does.
You know, to me, it's always been the difference between, you know, people who are, and this sort of goes into the conversation we're having as a country about quote-unquote identity politics, right? There's this idea that white people doing that, whether it is in the way David Duke does or the way Donald Trump does or the way, you know, there are all these different iterations of explicit or implicit white nationalism. There are those who say, well, it's all, you know, it's the fault of the left. You guys started, identity politics, which is, of course, hilarious because identity politics, when it comes to race, originates with whiteness itself. Like, there is no black or brown identity politics if there is no white supremacy. But it's also the difference between organizing for a seat at the table, or maybe several seats, which is what marginalized people are doing when they cleave to identity or perhaps engage in a form of implicit nationalism, as opposed to when white folks do it in a society like this, where that is about organizing not for a seat at the table, because you already own the table. It's about organizing to keep other people out of the banquet, right?
Exactly. And it was one of the things that used to drive me up the wall back in the 90s, when they would say that somebody that was engaged in black nationalism, and this is coming from the right, was at the very least a threat just waiting in the wings. It says, no, it's not. And we have since proven that it was not. When we talked about in the 90s how black people want to step up, it was number one, it was what they told us to do in the first place. Pull yourself up from your bootstraps and you can survive. But it was also our intent to become a part of this society, or at least create something that will make our communities viable.
And that gets back to the point about Antifa. I mean, it always has seemed rather evident to me that Antifa is first and foremost about opposing, as is the case with most movements that are rooted in political anarchism, sort of this notion of rejecting hierarchy and domination and subordination in all levels, whether that is the state and its various, you know, enforcers, the, you know, law enforcement, cops, military, etc., or whether it is private actors and the hierarchies within the marketplace, the hierarchies within capitalism. And again, it's certainly fine for people to disagree with the left take on that, but it isn't okay to mischaracterize it as fascist or authoritarian when it is clearly, for good or for bad, whatever one thinks about that structure or lack of structure or, you know, anti-fascist politic, to call it authoritarian is the exact opposite of what is being fought for. And it makes it really hard to have a conversation about what fascism is and what its opposite is when we have all of this misinformation, right?
And that's the point to it. That's the reason why they do it. They don't want to have this conversation. If there's one thing that you see the conservatives, the right wingers do repeatedly, is try to dilute any kind of attempt to have such a conversation on racism, on trying to bring us together and trying to address really our original sin, so to speak. I mean, I remember back in the day, back in 99, they were really angry at Bill Clinton when he wanted to have the national conversation on race.
And that was a very watered down conversation.
But this is what they do. They always get angry when the issue of racism comes up. And I always tell people that's because they are responsible for it. When you talk about conservatism, it is basically the villain in any scenario that you put forward when you discuss racism.
That's a really important point. You know, Corey Robin, political scientist, has written this book, The Reactionary Mind. And one of the things that he talks about, which really helped clarify for me a little bit, the right has a way of claiming that, you know, all they're about is, you know, small government and the free market and all of these, you know, niceties that people have heard for years and for decades. But really, if you trace the history of right-wing thinking, reactionary thinking, ultra-conservative thinking, it really hasn't been about that. It has been going all the way back to the French Revolution, at which point we start using these terms of left and right. It's always been about one side wanting to maintain traditional hierarchies, whether that was class, whether that was race, whether that was gender, religion, one could add to that sexuality, nation state domination, right? Empire. It's about saying that the traditional hierarchies are legitimate and should be maintained at all costs. And then the other side, the left, questioning the legitimacy of those hierarchies and actually saying, no, those hierarchies are invalid and should be rethought, and society should be reconfigured. Because that's one of the reasons the right will, on the one hand, say we're for small government, except when it's about regulating women's reproduction, or when it's about locking millions of people away for nonviolent offenses. Or, you know, we're about the free market, except for when it's subsidizing corporations to sell their products abroad and giving big, you know, tax breaks to companies to help them. In other words, that makes sense if you realize conservatism as being about hierarchy, domination, and ultimately maybe even a form of fascism. It doesn't make any sense if you buy the argument that conservatism is about small government and free markets.
If there's anything that this current administration is helping us out with, is exposing just how phony they are on a number of issues. I think about how they would lecture us about big government, how they would lecture us about religion and the rights of private industry, but when it only benefits them. Now that you have Donald Trump basically doing everything that they said we should not do, you see them supporting it and making excuses to for supporting it. And big government is one of those examples. I mean, you don't even have to look back at Trump. I'm sorry. You can actually go back to George Bush when they talk about how they want small government, but they really expanded it when it came to defense. I mean, they wanted fewer cabinet positions and the Department of Homeland Security comes out of the woodwork. I mean, we can go on forever about the hypocrisy on the right. One thing that I have an issue with is, what are we going to do about it?
Right. Well, one of the ways, obviously, that anti-fascist organizers have gone about challenging the right in that regard, whether that's the sort of mainstream dominant right or the extreme fascist, neo-fascist, white nationalist right, is obviously by, in many cases, taking to the streets to confront folks directly. And this is where, of course, the right-wing spin machine sort of comes in and says, ah, see, there's the evidence of fascism. It's because you go out and you yell at people and you throw bottles of water at them or whatever they want to claim is happening, whether it's, you know, the defensive tactics in the streets of Charlottesville or elsewhere, which again, it's not fascism on multiple levels, regardless of what one thinks of the tactics that are sometimes employed, and we can discuss that and we will. It ain't fascism because fascism requires the power of the state when it deploys that violence. So fascism would be much more like what police did in Ferguson or Baltimore than what Antifa did in Charlottesville. Just so we're clear, you know, ideologically, but for those who look at certain tactics that they see as the sum total of Antifa organizing, which I know it is not, you know it is not, but I want people to understand when they see those kind of tactics and they get all nervous or they worry, and I don't always agree with every single demo or tactic that Antifa organizers use. But of course, we always disagree about tactics on the left, just like people on the right do, and we can have those discussions among friends. But what do people need to know about, number one, the importance of occasionally deploying tactics that are confrontational, and number two, how much of Antifa work isn't even about that at all? Because to me, the vast majority of Antifa work is about research and exposing people and doing the investigative journalism work that other media outlets don't want to do. To me, that's like 20 hours out of the day, and maybe 4 hours is confrontation. But maybe I'm getting the mix wrong. Tell me a little bit about that.
Hey, no, that's pretty much right. And to your point, there's been a number of stories that I have written that me and my team have done research on that has ended up in the mainstream press that would have otherwise ignored it. Right. And I think that speaks to why they are concerned about Antifa, because that's exactly what Antifa does for the most part. One of the strongest anti-fascist groups out there is a group called Rose City Antifa. And all they had done over 10, 15 years was document all the neo-Nazis in Portland, Oregon. They're one of the main reasons why the neo-Nazi group Volksfront folded. So naturally, the folks who keep on trying to make excuses for this crowd and try to downplay any discussion about racism are going to get ticked off when somebody actually takes the bull by the horns and says, this is going to stop. So here comes all the gaslighting. Yes, they're going to talk about the fighting and all that. And let's face it, I am not innocent in that regard. I have gotten myself into a number of tussles in my younger years, but that's not the totality of what I do. There is a reason why I handle myself that way. There's a reason why everyone handles themselves that way. Portland again. We're talking about a group called Patriot Prayer that went to a Antifa event in Portland, Oregon, to try to cause some drama. And they got turned out. They got chased away. They got beat down and all of that. They were defending themselves. The Antifa there were defending themselves against somebody who came to them. Needless to say, the right decided to say Antifa attacked them. It's not flying, and that's why Patriot Prayer and their leader Joey Gibson are getting sued by the club that they was hassling. So it remains to be seen how much of this gaslighting is going to actually work.
Well, you know, clearly it's worked on some folks, because when you go back and you look at Charlottesville in August of 2017, you know, it's very obvious for people who were there, or for those who looked very carefully at the, you know, long video clips, who instigated both the drama and the violence. First of all, it was the purpose for which right-wingers came to Charlottesville was to unite the right, which the president has apparently ignored when he tries to argue about the fine people, you know, on that side of the aisle. This was a movement. No, not everybody who went was a Nazi, but everybody who went was willing to break bread with Nazis. Let's be clear. Everyone who went on that side was willing to say, in the name of uniting the right, that's their title. You didn't give them that name. I didn't give them that name. That's their name. They were willing to say whatever differences we have, like Gavin McGinnis and the Proud Boys say, right, no punching right. We're not going to punch right. We're not going to criticize anyone to the right. Well, when you say that, you are telling me that if you're not a Nazi, you're okay with the ones who are. So then, when Antifa organizers attempt to defend the city of Charlottesville, and even the night before, the campus of the University of Virginia, where these guys marched with their tiki torches to, I think that was not the Robert E. Lee statue. I think that was a Jefferson statue, right, that was on the campus. And you had Antifa organizers and left progressive radical organizers trying to, oddly enough, encircle the Jefferson statue, not because they're big fans of Thomas Jefferson's racial politics, but because they wanted to make a showing against these Nazis who were coming onto the campus. And all of the evidence says that the Nazis waded into the group of anti-fascist organizers. And then when the anti-fascist organizers fought back in some cases, then it becomes this both sides narrative. Given the fact that that happens, that you know it's going to happen, right? That you know the media is going to spin it as this both sides narrative. Are there any ways, or is it just one of those things you just say, well, they're going to do that, but there's nothing we can do? Are there ways that organizers who were out confronting fascists can gain some control over that narrative? Is there anything tactically or strategically that makes you think about as an organizer? Or is it just one of those things that you know you can't control it, so you got to go do what you got
to
do?
Well, to some degree, you can't control it. They're going to say what they're going to say. This is one of the reasons why we have to have more of a public face. We actually need to start getting people to hear where we're coming from as opposed to what Fox News says we do. And I'm going to tell you something. Charlottesville, we did that. Charlottesville was a good example of how the gaslighting of that sort did not work, because they saw who came out with the tiki torches. They saw who came out with the semi-automatic weapons, and they saw who killed someone.
Right.
And really, when the death happened, it always sucks that it always happens after somebody dies. When they see who was responsible for deaths like that, that's when people started saying, okay, they are the bad guys. The people that were fighting them were the good guys, and we got to take their side. God bless Cornel West. First of all, that was the first time I had ever seen anybody of note come to something like this. And he went on various news outlets and said, no, the Antifa were defending us. They were protecting us.
Well, I think you're right. I think that by and large, the way that Charlottesville is understood by most people who are willing to see the truth, and that, of course, by definition, excludes a large contingent of the Trump MAGA hat-wearing folks who are not going to see the truth. But sort of average everyday people, I think you're right. I think there is a perception that Antifa was on the good side, and these Nazis were the problem, and they were the instigators. Of course, there have been several indictments now and prosecutions, yep, successful prosecutions of some of the main organizers. And most of those organizers now have been either run off of social media or limited in their ability to reach folks. There's been quite sort of a crack up a little bit on the right. And let's talk a little about that, because one of the things that concerns me coming out of Charlottesville, other than, of course, how frightening it is that openly fascist Nazi organizers are able to pull off such a huge rally, which, let's be honest, like 15 or 20 years ago, I don't think that would have happened. So something is clearly going on, and we need to talk about what that is. But the other thing that concerned me was, once we saw some of these right-wing organizations, you know, the sort of the infighting that brought down, the Traditionalist Workers Party folks, you know, Matt Heimbach and Matt Parrott, you know, or the fact that Richard Spencer realized after Charlottesville, I think, that things were sort of going south. It's clearly been a setback for them. But I also am worried that we get a false sense of security because we see some of the infighting and we see some of the groups fading and we see some of the people falling apart. But I'm worried that sometimes we go, oh, good, you know, these folks they're done with now. Tell people why that is dangerous for us to believe that.
Well, it's also one of the things I am concerned about after Trump. When Trump leaves, yeah, everybody's, yeah, going to stop paying attention to this crowd. One of the other reasons why people started gravitating towards my organization is because we were one of the few that had information on these groups before they became the so-called alt-right, before Trump got into power and all that. We were basically screaming into the woods that, you know, there's this guy named Jared Taylor that everybody needs to start paying attention to, because he's bringing in some nasty people, yeah, who, yeah, are trying to get into politics. And, I mean, they are working within the Beltway. We found Richard Spencer back in 2006, 2007, basically because we were chasing after Jared Taylor. And once we found Spencer, we says, here's an up-and-comer y'all need to pay attention to. No one cared.
Right, and Richard Spencer, when he was at Duke, was connected to Stephen Miller, who, exactly, now works in the White House. So, I mean,
and I make that point all the time too. Yeah. And I tell people, look, you got the basic narrative against confronting these characters, against dealing with them in the past, was if you ignore them, they will go away. This is the crowd that wanted you to ignore them. And one of the reasons why they don't like Antifa is because we didn't do that. We did not ignore them. And we were basically just telling people, hey, this is who we're dealing with. Now, it's only because they got to where they wanted to be that people are taking notice and trying to do something. And I'm trying to make the most of it, yeah, right now, because I am afraid that after Trump, yeah, leaves, you're going to start hearing from our side that, oh, the threat has been vacated. We don't have to worry about it anymore. We have beaten them.
One of the best examples of this historically that I can think of, and it speaks to, you know, my experience in this work. I mean, the very first thing that I did in this movement was the work against David Duke in Louisiana. And, you know, at that time, we're talking 88, 89 when he runs for and ultimately wins the state house seat, 90 when he runs for Senate, 91 when he runs for governor. There was a real struggle between, you know, those of us who saw this as a longer term project against what we at that time were calling Dukeism, right? Not Duke, but Dukeism, which was really just a more extreme version of the race politics that mainstream right-wingers had been running on since at least George Wallace, if not before, certainly since Nixon. And now we might call it Trumpism because it's morphed. And at the time, there were a bunch of... I remember when Duke was finally defeated in that governor's race, which I always, you know, have to remind people, yes, he lost, but it wasn't because of white folks. 55 out of 100 white folks, 55%, voted for him in the governor's race, 60% in the Senate race. So if we're up to white people, we'd have had a Nazi in the U.S. Senate. We would have had a Nazi as governor of the state. But when he faded, it was interesting. Those of us, I worked for a group called the Louisiana Coalition Against Racism and Nazism. It wasn't the Louisiana Coalition Against David Duke. It was against racism and Nazism. But as soon as Duke was defeated, like donations dried up, everybody was like, oh, we defeated racism and Nazism. No, you defeated a Nazi. You defeated a racist. And then, but then the thing is, that particular Nazi who I think, even I thought at one point, like, okay, he really is done. He's gone to prison for embezzlement and tax evasion and all this stuff. He personally is done, even if I knew the movement wasn't. Shit, he's not done. He shows up in Charlottesville and says he's there to fulfill the agenda and the promises of Donald Trump. And, you know, there are a lot of folks, even today, being radicalized by Duke Online and by people who were part of that network 30 years ago. So none of this shit ever goes away until it's defeated. And when people get excited because, you know, our side won, despite the death of Heather Heyer in Charlottesville, our side maybe won the narrative and won the day in the eyes of the nation. But that's one battle in a really long war. Where do you think the turn came, if there was one, in, let's say, the Republican Party towards a more open flirtation with fascism? And the reason I ask that is one of the dangers that I think sometimes we on the left don't acknowledge, or one of the traps we fall into, is it is very tempting. And I remember this during the anti-Duke work. I remember it being very tempting for some of my friends on the left to say, well, David Duke is just, he's no different than Ronald Reagan. You know, it's just Reagan. It's just Goldwater. It's just all the same shit. And my thing was, look, I get your point. I do understand that race politics have been part of the country going back to the colonial period, for God's sake. So I get that. But there is a danger in equivalizing absolute overt fascist and white supremacist with people who dog whistle. Like the difference between Reagan and Nixon, right? Those are people that believed in dog whistling to gain power, which is evil on its own level. David Duke ain't dog whistling. Like David Duke and those guys are bullhorning everything. And Trump, to some extent, is doing that as well, even though I would say there are obviously distinctions between Duke and Trump as well. But to what extent do you think the party, because I do think there has been a change from the politics of dog whistle to the more open politics of white resentment. A, do you think I'm right? And if so, where do you think that change begins to happen?
We could always make the argument that it probably started with Reagan.
Yeah.
Because if you look back and you see the paleo, see some of the figures that were in Reagan's era today, you would think that they were David Duke. You would think that they were just as bad as anybody that we see on the alt-right today. But I don't think that'll be fair in this context, only because now when you do that, you're really talking about folks who grew up promoting Jim Crow, who was all about this. And it's a different generation. It's a different dynamic with them. I think we could make the argument that it started with Bush and George W. Bush and 9/11. But in all fairness, George W. Bush was more of an elitist than he was a racist, and he really wasn't about the white nationalist thing. I'm going to go with Obama. I'm going to go with Obama when Obama came into office, because as I have said many a time, when a black man became president, the conservatives in this country saw themselves as the ones that let that happen, and they freaked out.
I remember there was quite a bit of chatter on far-right and white supremacist boards. I remember there was chatter on Stormfront and some others. There were white nationalists who were actually quite wanting Obama to win, precisely for the purpose of accelerationism, right? This notion that it will make the contradictions between multiracial democracy and white nationalism even more obvious, and it'll be great, and it'll be helpful. Sort of the same way, you know, Billy Roper right after 9/11, and for those who don't know, Billy Roper, this longtime neo-Nazi activist in Arkansas with the National Alliance for many years before William Pierce died, Billy Roper wrote famously, like within an hour or two of 9/11, that he had great respect for the hijackers who flew the planes into the buildings, and he wished that, you know, his movement had people with half the balls or something like that. So they sort of want these things to happen to accelerate the process of deterioration of the society. And in the case of Obama, their whole thing was, look, we don't like Obama's politics. We just think it's great. If a black dude becomes president, that'll just make all of the people who are nervous about that see more clearly, right? That mm-hmm. we have to rise up. And obviously that's not a reason to oppose Obama, but it is something right. that I don't think people were aware of. I don't think there were people who understood that it was being used as a recruiting tool by the far right.
Well, it was funny because there was the whole thing about being a little bit more open. We started to see more open fascists with Obama, of course, but there was still the dog whistles.
Yeah.
The dog whistles really did stop with Trump. Now they were open. Now they thought they can get away with everything. One of the people that spoke at a David Duke conference is the House Minority Whip Steve Scalise, who called himself David Duke without the baggage. And for some strange reason, no one wants to talk about that. It's great to take down Steve King, but Steve Scalise is still getting a pass?
Right. And he ran very much saying that he was Duke without the sheets. Pat Buchanan, of course, in 92, said that the Republican Party needed to copy David Duke's winning playbook. I mean, that was, you know, his phrase in a syndicated column at that time as he's running for president. Where does the Jewish piece of it come in? Because one of the things that you could always count on the, you know, even with Duke, I mean, you know, David Duke obviously is principally motivated by his hatred of Jewish folks. There's no question. I mean, like his racism toward black folks is very real, but it's very much of sort of a pitying kind of, oh, they're inferior, you know, we're smarter than they are. But with Jewish folks, he actually sees Jews as evil. That kind of politics was so toxic, even in 90 and 91, that although that was what he was about, he never talked about it. In fact, his campaign advisors told him, David, you got to stop talking about the Jews. First of all, there's only 14,000 of them in the state of Louisiana. Secondly, ain't nobody worried about them. You got to stay on black folks. And he's like, oh, okay. You know, and so he would go back to black folks. But now we're in this interesting moment where open articulation of anti-Jewish bigotry, which we really had not seen at this level in my lifetime, and I say that as someone who's Jewish, and I think if it had been happening at this level, I would have known it, is sort of at this high level. Where does that, is that part of Pat Buchanan's influence on the right over the last 30 years? What is that about?
Well, remember that when you're talking, I'm so glad you brought up Pat Buchanan, because the fact of the matter is Pat Buchanan is really the well from which all of this is sprung. When you talk about how, originally I said that Jared Taylor was one of those white supremacists who kept everything in the beltway. He was trying to basically push those politics up above ground in the beltway. Well, he's a friend of Pat Buchanan's. He's a friend of Peter Brimelow's. So, you know, anti-Semitism has always been there. The reason why we see it up close and personal now is because the folks, as we push forward the paleo conservatives and the alt-right knuckleheads, so-called alt-right knuckleheads, into the forefront, they're bringing the Nazis along with them.
Right.
And since they are getting their chance to shine, they're going to try to shine.
It's been made a lot easier by the technologies that these folks use. And again, this is, I mean, I remember, and you mentioned it a second ago, this sort of myth that if we just ignore them, they'll go away. It was obvious that that wasn't true even in a pre-internet age. It is sure as hell obvious now. I mean, the idea that, like, well, you don't want to give, I remember people saying, you don't want to take the time to respond to David Duke or respond to this person or Jared Taylor, for instance. Years ago, when I first became aware of Jared Taylor and he had that really effective, and I still think it's the most effective piece of racist propaganda I've seen in my lifetime, the Color of Crime Report, which is utter bullshit. Like, it's completely wrong in the way that it interprets crime data, but it has that semi-official look to it. And so I remember sitting down to write a rebuttal, and I've written a couple of things in response to it. And I remember people on the left saying, don't do that. You're going to give attention. You're going to don't give him the platform. I'm like, dude, he's got a platform. He's got his own fucking website. What are you talking about?
Yeah. And meanwhile, prominent conservatives like David Horowitz was making the Color of Crime available for download on his website. And David Horowitz was is a big fan of Jared Taylor and his crew.
Oh, yeah. No, David Horowitz called him. Yeah, David Horowitz actually referred to him. Here's a guy who wants to pose as this very mainstream conservative activist, former, you know, as he tells everyone, former leftist in the 60s and early 70s, and now this conservative. He was all down with Reagan. And now, yeah, he said several years back in the early 2000s, referred to Jared Taylor, who is an open white nationalist, an open believer in white ethnostates, that he called him a gutsy individualist and a highly principled man. You know, I mean, just amazing stuff that people don't realize how close to the mainstream that actually is.
And that's one of the frustrating things about this. Because, see, when I'm dealing with some of the folks on the so-called alt-right, when I'm dealing with them face-to-face and we're yelling and screaming at them, calling them Nazis and such, some of them would try to play this game. And this is only happening in the D.C. area. Some of the more prominent ones would try to say, how can you say that I'm Jewish? We have pictures of people at the Richard Spencer Conference, Sikh Highland, who are Jewish. And this is where you start realizing that it's not so much about racism. It's not so much about anti-Semitism. It's about pure fascism. That's all it is. It's about an authoritarianism on the right that's not being checked. One of the people that infiltrated my group was a black Nazi.
Talk about that one for a second.
He infiltrated my group. His name was Gabriel Diaz, a young kid. He met one of my people at a National Socialist Movement rally in Ohio. He called himself Muhammad. And he said he wanted to be in, wanted to be involved in our work. So she passed him off to me. He lives in the Bronx, and I hung out with him for about a year or so. And he went to one Antifa conference, and then we found out later that he was giving all of our information to the National Socialist Movement.
Wow.
Now, luckily for us, it was the National Socialist Movement. They were dumber than a sack of rocks, and all they did with the information was make crank calls. Yeah. One of those crank calls referenced something that happened that only he and I knew. So I called up one of our people and told them, this is weird. What is going on here? How did that happen? So my person took his phone number and ran it through the internet, found the name Gabriel Diaz. Googled the name Gabriel Diaz. Gabriel Diaz is on YouTube talking about how much of a National Socialist he was to CBS News.
What's fascinating, because I know this person you're talking about, and I remember seeing some of his stuff online and just thinking, wow, it's bizarre. But here's the thing that's interesting. And I think you made a great point when you said that even more than just racism or anti-Semitism, there's a real tendency toward authoritarian and fascist thinking that's at the root of it. That also might explain, wouldn't it, why there are many men of color who are part of the Proud Boys and all that bullshit. Talk a little bit about that, because I think people find that fascinating, because it is hard, right, to call the Proud Boys, even though it's very obvious, they call themselves European chauvinists, which...
They call themselves Western chauvinists.
Oh, right. They call themselves Western. That's right. Western.
That distinction speaks to where we're at right now.
Right, right. Western chauvinist. But it's very clear if you were to ask them, well, what is Western civilization? From whence does it spring? They are thinking about white people. I mean, they are clearly, even though the West and it has been shaped by lots of people who are not quote-unquote white, we know what they mean when they say it. But why would people of color be attracted to these neo-masculinist, Western chauvinist, highly, really bigoted organizations? Because that is a phenomena that I think complicates the ability to simply go, oh, these are just Nazis or these are just racists, right? So talk a little bit about that.
Well, back in the day, whenever you saw black conservatives out there doing this, I just thought that was stupid. I just thought it was dumb. But I understood that it was just an opportunity to try to get people involved in the mainstream of society, and that was the way they thought they can do it. Today, it actually makes a lot more sense that you would see this now, because as we become more and more a part of today's culture and today's society, today's mainstream society, naturally you're going to have some of us leaning rightward. When you think about a lot of our communities, black and Hispanic communities, some of us are particularly conservative within our communities.
Yeah.
So we bring that conservatism with us. And with that, so long as we're already conservative and already accepted, we just figure, hey, why don't we give fascism a spin? As long as we are a part of a society We are always going to have those folks who want to be traditionalists about that society, who want to try to preserve that traditionalism. And many will go to the extremes to do it.
It's always been hard, I think, for certain people to get their head around the idea that oppressed and marginalized peoples can often mimic the politic of their oppressor. But why does that surprise us? I mean, that's not really shocking, right? If you're marginalized and shit on for years, there comes a point where you have to make a decision. And the decision is you either become a revolutionary to try to change that system, which, let's be honest, is really hard to do, right? Or you try to cut the best deal that you can within that system, right? And so the Irish did this when they came to the United States, and they were told very clearly by their religious leaders in their homeland, hey, if you go to America, God bless and good luck, but you must join the abolitionist struggle because we were the slaves of the English. And the Irish got on the boat and said, oh yeah, okay, we'll totally do that. And then they came to New York and burned down a black orphanage at the beginning of the draft riots in New York City because they so didn't want to fight for the emancipation of black people because they wanted to be on the winning team, right? And it's sort of the same thing, isn't it?
The same rule applies. And that's one of the reasons why I say you're going to see a lot more people of color going towards the Republican Party at some point, sometime within the next 10 to 15 years. Because right now, the people, the young people that I see today aren't the young people that we were 20 years ago. A lot of them don't have the same kind of struggles that, say, my father did in Newark, New Jersey. Some of them, like myself, grew up in the suburbs. So if you're detached from that, you don't relate to that, that's not you. But some right-wing, some conservative arenas are going to be more to your speed. So yeah, you're going to start seeing more people of color in there, and I'm fine with that. I'd rather have those kinds of discussions and arguments. But just like anything else, when I'm dealing with folks that go to the extreme in that regard, we got to handle it like that. And remember this: always remember that oppressed people, marginalized people, have no intentions of staying that way.
And we ought not romanticize, just because somebody's been marginalized, it doesn't convey upon them greater humanity. It doesn't suggest that they're automatically going to be, I mean, as someone who is both Jewish but also anti-Zionist, I know how my people have taken tragedy over many, many generations and centuries and oftentimes deployed that in tragic ways against others. It's not surprising. There is a desire on the part of marginalized peoples, like you said, not to be marginalized anymore. And frankly, it is sometimes easier, and this is the horrible, disturbing thing about society building, it is sometimes easier to mimic oppression than it is to really fight in a solidarity-based way. But I think one of the points you made that's so important, and this is something moving forward that may help strategically, I think the thing that gets everybody twisted up is because we think of racism and anti-Semitism as these individual pathologies, when we see people of color manifesting in these movements that are racist, or we see Jews manifesting in these movements that are anti-Semitic, we go, wait, that doesn't make sense. I don't understand. But that's because we're thinking of these things as personal pathologies rather than systemic pathologies, right? If racism and white supremacy are about an ideology and a system, it doesn't mean that everybody who's down with that has to be white. And it doesn't mean that all white people have to be down with that.
Yeah, as one of the funny things is that it's the neo-Nazis themselves that try to make that point to us. They say, hey, look, anybody can be a National Socialist within their own communities.
Part of the really great work that I have seen done, like I said, with some of this investigative journalistic work, really, about exposing people who are connected in a number of ways, both to the movement and these ideologies of hate. And I know that one of the things that you all try to do is expose folks who, you know, in various communities, like you said, Rose City Antifa, of course, in Portland and others around the country do that. Do you have any concern? And I'm going to play devil's advocate here for a second, and partly devil's advocate, partly because I really sort of am curious your answer. Is there some concern about who you expose and who you don't expose? Like, for instance, obviously, if there's a judge, a cop, a teacher, a doctor, someone in a position of power and trust and influence, I think most people would say, yeah, you know, if you got a teacher who's a white nationalist, that's got to be exposed, and wherever the chips fall, they fall. Is it also true for the guy who's working down at like the fast food joint, who maybe or works as a mechanic at the auto body shop? Is there any concern about who you target for that kind of stuff? And then secondly, is there any concern at all about the downsides of doxing certain individuals, given the way in which, you know, people, I mean, they're loose cannon folks, right, politically all around the spectrum. And as someone who's been doxed and been threatened and had my life and the lives of my family members threatened for the work I do, I often worry about that as a tool. Talk a little bit about the limitations of that tool, the benefits of that tool. Are there ways that you deploy it and don't deploy it within this movement that you think are better or worse? I know that's a lot of questions, but...
Well, No. I already have the answer to that. And curiously enough, somebody from a fast food joint did get fired after they realized that he went to Charlottesville. He got doxed and he was history. I would say that really it's... We always ask for any and all information about every last person. The only time we pull back on information, the only time we wouldn't dox someone, so to speak, if it's a minor. Now you're messing around with a lot of situations that you really don't want to get into. You're talking about legalities, and you're also talking about somebody who's still growing up. So when we do come across kids, however, we try to find ways to deal with it behind the scenes. Like one time we found a high school white power group. We just called their parents, and it was the end of the group.
Yeah, when mom and dad find out that their little bundle of joy is on 8chan posting Nazi memes, that sort of tends to...
Oh, yeah. That's the other reason why you don't go after kids. You might have an ally in their parents. I mean, call them, let them know what's going on, first and foremost. Limitations, I think the issue that I would have is, as I said, we would like to put any and all information out there is because... No matter how big you are, no matter how small you are, you can still be a concern. I mean, you may be working at a fast food joint, but that money that you're making could be going to your next weapon that you're taking to a school somewhere. So it's like everybody who's going to be a part of this kind of ideal, I mean, because this is not a real ideology. When you talk about fascism, when you talk about Nazism, you're not talking about something that can be ironed out, you know. Right. We're talking about something that is just totally destructive. There is no real purpose for it.
That's a critical distinction because I think one of the things that we don't talk about enough, and I remember learning this, you know, when I was studying these philosophies, you know, in philosophy classes and in college even, that argument that, look, Nazism and fascism are not these broad-based ideologies where there are like multiple permutations, the way that there are, let's say, with socialism, right? With left socialism. Right. There are as many versions of left socialism as there are left socialists. Like there are, you know, multiple arguments within like the Marxist tradition. And, you know, some of those spinoffs of the Marxist tradition are highly authoritarian, highly totalitarian, and hated every bit as much by anti-authoritarian people as most any kind of fascism. There are others that are much more decentralized. But within fascism, within Nazism, within race-based nationalism, those arguments, I mean, like the only arguments there are like, do we kill them now or do we kill them later? Like that's...
Exactly.
They're not arguing over like, you know, the finer points of how you set up the society. It's about, well, do we gas this group first or do we gas this group first?
And we're not talking about traditionalism. I mean, the only thing, the closest thing to a defense of any of this is that, sure, you want to maintain traditions. But that's it. If you want to maintain traditions, you can do that differently.
I had an argument with Matt Heimbach once about this. Before he and Parrott had the falling out that they had, and before the traditionalists, it was at that time it was still TYN, Traditionalist Youth Network, before it became a workers' party. I guess they got a little too old to call themselves youth, and so they pretended that they were workers. But Matt Heimbach and his buddies came to my talk at Indiana State, I think it was. And I always have a habit of, and I've gotten flack for this too, but this is just the way that I operate. I have no problem with those folks coming into my talk if they will behave, if they will not heckle. I will give them the first question after my talk. I will give them a follow-up question after the first question. I have no problem doing that. I'm not going to let them filibuster and give a speech. No, I'm not going to share the mic. No, but I'm going to let them in. And I don't. And I offered that years ago to Kyle Bristow in Michigan. He never took me up on it. I've offered it to several people. Heimbach took the offer. He comes in and he asks a question. And his question, which again speaks to the real motivation here, his question was, and it goes to your point about how this isn't just about traditionalism. He said, look, Tim, if white people are so horrible, which of course is a caricature of my argument anyway, so he's already, you know, operating on a horrible false premise. There's a lot in that premise. Number one, that's what I've said. Number two, that I'm not white, which is only what you believe if you think Jews aren't white, and that's a Nazi thing. You know, so he's already, there's multiple premises. But he says, if you think we're so horrible, then why don't you just let us go on our way and have our own, you know, our own land? And I'm like, dude, there's plenty of land out west. Why don't y'all go buy some? Just go buy some land, man. Why don't y'all get your shit together and move out and set up a compound like they tried to do in Oklahoma with Elohim City or whatever that was, or you know, the folks that have, there's folks in the Northwest that have set up these little intentional communities. And of course, none of these have worked. They've all failed because these master race people ain't so smart. But I said, Matt, nobody's stopping you, dude. I would love it if y'all would just pack up your shit, hit the road, go out there, build an electricity grid, build your own water supply. You know, there are all kinds of religious sects that do that, right? There's fundamentalist Mormons that have set up their own little communities. As far as I'm concerned, go out there and do that. But what
the Amish?
Yeah, a lot of people do that, and nobody's stopping them. But the real point is, they don't want to just live by their own traditional rules. They want to make others live by those rules. They don't want to move out there. They want to impose that on us. And it was obvious when he didn't take the... I mean, I offered it to him. I said, dude, I am quite confident that every one of us who can't stand y'all would be happy to... I'll give you the map. I'll give you the... I'll put a pin in the map where you could set that shit up. But you don't want to do it because you don't want to build the roads yourself. You don't want to build the electrical grid yourself. You don't want to dig the trenches for the sewers. You want to use the stuff that we all contributed to create your little utopia. That's not about tradition. That's about imposition on other people, right?
Right. And it's funny, I had a conversation with Heimbach myself. And one of the things that I said is that the biggest problem that we have with y'all is the fact that while you say you want to do that, fascism has a nasty habit of not staying within its borders. If there's anybody next to them or somewhere nearby that has something that they want, they try to go and get it. The best thing, one of the things that, in regards to Heimbach that speaks to that is his love for Alexander Dugin out in Russia. Yeah. Alexander Dugin wants to reconstitute the Soviet Union as a fascist state. Now, if you do that, that means all these new independent states that have been around for almost 30 years are about to get swallowed up again and turned into something that they don't want to be, because you want to create a domination, not just power, not just a community for yourselves. You want to dominate. That's why we keep saying white supremacy when they try to say, no, we are actually white separatists. No, you're not. If you were white separatists, you would be separate. You would not be here. We would not know you.
And you're right. There's that again speaks to this need to impose upon others, which is why anti-fascist movements are so important, because it's really about resisting the authoritarian impulse. Given the way that white anxiety has been ramped up in the last decade, and given the fact that we've got these shock troops of the far, far, far right who are doing everything they can to exploit that anxiety, you know, they were going to the Tea Party rallies in 2009 and 2010 with the deliberate goal of taking these sort of regular right-wingers and making them into white nationalists. They're doing the same thing with the MAGA hat-wearing folks. What does that mean then for those of us strategically, tactically? What are the things that we, and when I say we now, I just mean the broader universe of the liberal left, everything from just sort of mainstream liberal folk all the way over to left folk. What do we need to be doing given the fact that white anxiety is real, it is ramped up to a level we haven't seen in a long time, and that demographic change is intensifying the realization, I guess, on the part of white folks that we ain't the norm anymore. That, you know, for me, that's not a problem. There are a lot of us who embrace multiracial democracy who are white, but there are an awful lot who don't. So what does that leave us with strategically? How do we organize against what we can predict will be, in Carol Anderson's words, Emory University professor, this upsurge of white rage? What does that mean for us?
Well, I think for us, we just basically have to, in some respects, we have to stay the course. We are already doing the right thing. We don't have to always be angry about it. I think with me in particular, I think it's more or less use what's going on right now to show everyone what we are talking about and why it's wrong. I mean, that's how it's working. And that's one of the reasons why you as a white man can take the side of right. But by the same token, that's also going to be the reason why others are going to come on board. We are not going to stay like this forever. I mean, yes, the white rage is going to be there. They're going to be a lot more lashing out. I always talk about how the Trump presidency is just a Hail Mary, but it's going to stop. And you're going to start seeing more people of color, a more diverse background of people in the mainstream contributing, producing, and making something out of whatever the society ends up being. Now, we just talked about earlier that you do have people of color who's going to go to the extreme right. That just simply means that you have to maintain that vigilance. You have to just be eternal with that vigilance, because there's always going to be someone who is going to try to achieve more power than they should be allowed. There's always going to be someone trying to game the system. So we always have to protect ourselves from that. That's not going to stop. And that's one of the things that I have to stress when it comes to what happens after Trump leaves.
People need to understand that these anti-fascist groups, including One People's Project, your group, you're doing the work that journalists then sort of, after the fact, sort of pick up on. And, you know, if people don't like y'all exposing them, then get the Washington Post to do it rather than these puff pieces they do where they go and sit down with Nazis and try to find out, well, gosh, what makes them tick? You know, they do all these human interest stories where it's like, let's get to know a Nazi today. I mean, the Washington Post did a piece that featured six white nationalists after Charlottesville. And it was, you know, it was Matt Parrott. Yeah. It was that dude down in Florida who's now doing time for the shooting after Richard Spencer's event at the University of Florida. He was featured in it and basically all but admitted in the interview that eventually he's going to end up shooting somebody or killing somebody, you know. And so we do all these puff pieces. Meanwhile, y'all are out doing real journalism and people are saying, oh, you're going to get somebody hurt.
See, we're going to get somebody hurt for telling people that these characters want to hurt people.
Right, now, right.
That's one of the things that for years, and you've seen this yourself, we will sit there and they get mad at us trying to dehumanize these folks while they're humanizing them. You would see them with the documentaries. You would see them with the news stories and the spotlights.
And again, I think, you know, for those of us on the left, yeah, we should have really deep conversations about what tactics and what strategies are best in given moments. And those are great conversations to have. And they're really good people who are going to have different takes on that. But it strikes me that the people who are most critical, I mean, uniformly critical of Antifa as a movement or as a contingent within the work, is that it's not that they're out there actively doing other stuff that is more effective. They're not doing anything. And yet they're going to yell at y'all for taking a more confrontational approach. Well, you know, if there were evidence that somebody could present that says, hey, this approach over here is more effective at getting rid of fascism than confrontation, then I'm sure you'd be down to do that other thing. I mean, as someone, okay, you know, like, we're not, no one okay is wedded to a tactic. We're wedded to stopping white nationalism, white supremacy, and fascism. Whatever works, I'm down. Like, if handing Richard Spencer lollipops every day would get rid of Richard Spencer as a threat, I'll do it, man. Like, I don't care. Yeah. I'll send him a chocolate bar in the mail. But there's no evidence that this sort of hands-off approach works, right?
But here's the question, too. You have to ask yourself, even if that person is on the left, are they really interested in stopping this? Because, and not so much because they are racist themselves, but just like, here's what we see in the mainstream, with mainstream liberals, just as much as the conservatives would try to maintain traditionalism, so were liberals to some degree, because you're talking about destabilizing. When we dealt with the civil rights movement, that's why Martin Luther King wrote Letter from a Birmingham Jail. Martin Luther King was writing Letter from a Birmingham Jail to a group of pastors that were trying to say Martin Luther King was wrong for all the rabble rousing and that we should just let all of these problems work themselves out in the courts. And Martin Luther King says, no, that's not going to work. We're right. dealing with that same kind of situation now, and we have been for a very long time. People really freak out over someone that's rocking the boat. But sometimes the boat just doesn't need to be rocked. It needs to be capsized. And you're going to get some pushback from a good cross-section of society when you do that, right or wrong. And unfortunately, a lot of conservatives do like to exploit that when it comes to how liberals and the mainstream of society respond. And that's a problem for us.
Sure. What are some things that people can do? Because here's the thing that I'm very aware of as someone who's, you know, been a leftist for a long time. I've been an organizer. I've been a writer. I do all of these different things over the years. I am very aware that there are some people who I think are really committed to a progressive multiracial democracy, but they're just, you know, they are just sort of like dispositionally right. They're not going to come to a demo. They're not going to come and confront, you know, these fascists face to face, but they still, there's a role they can still play. What is that role for people who maybe are just, their personality is that they're not confrontational, but they want to do something? What are some things, what are some everyday kind of things that people can do to fight fascism and to fight white supremacy and all of these evils that we're talking about, even if they're not necessarily going to come out to a demo? Because we got to give them something. So what could that be?
No, you don't have to come out to a demo. As a matter of fact, I always try to tell everybody that we should not be working on their timetable in the first place. I think after Charlottesville, it was really important to see how people responded to that, because all of a sudden folks realized that there was an issue and they started doing things. When we talked about earlier about how folks were getting fired from their jobs, whether it is from Boeing or a hot dog stand, that's one way. I think the biggest thing, the most important thing is to support those that are going to be on the front lines and to take what they are producing, what they're showing everyone, and using it as a blueprint as to how to deal with it in your community. I mean, when you are dealing with someone who is a teacher, for example, who is a teacher teaching your kids in your community, that person is going to be a problem for any student of color that's in their class. Yeah. I mean, so you yeah. already know you got an issue there. It's that little thing. Just basically, I would say, just support us, help us get the information out there. And address it soberly.
How are some ways that people can particularly support your work and the work of One People's Project? Because I want people to be able to reach out, be in touch with you. I know you guys have a blog as well. You have a good social media presence. You also, I know there's some links to various documentaries and things on your website. How are some ways that people can support you in that work?
Well, with One People's Project, our website is onepeoplesproject.com. Our newsline is idavox.com. It's named after Ida B. Wells, who did this kind of work back in her day, trying to cover the lynchings when no one else would.
Right.
So we named our newsline Idavox because we're pretty much doing the same work. I think we need people. If people can help us out with resources like finances and stuff, where you can always donate to One People's Project on our website, onepeoplesproject.com. We're looking for writers. We can't pay anybody yet. But we're looking for writers. We're looking for people to give us information about what it is they see out there that they are concerned with. And that's not just racism. I'm talking about any kind of Islamophobia, any kind of anti-Semitism, any kind of homophobia, xenophobia, any of the phobias. All of these kinds of things. Everyone needs to know about it. I think that's the most important thing in the world. That old cliche, sunlight is the best disinfectant, is very, very true.
And that'll do it for another episode of Speak Out with Tim Wise. Please join me again in 2 weeks for the next episode of the show. And in the meantime, you can check out my articles at medium.com, as well as my website, www.timwise.org. And follow the show on Facebook at Speak Out with Tim Wise, on Twitter at Speak Out Tim Wise, as well as on Instagram. Take care, and join us again in 2 weeks.